It's the 12th of August 2011 and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is education these days reading, rioting and arithmetic? Is there a psychological explanation for the riots, or are teenagers genetically programmed to break into JD Sports? Does a swine flu vaccine cause narcolepsy, or were the scientists that discovered this up past their bedtimes? After 100 years of the Parliament Act, are we any closer to electing the Lords? Is Top Gear a bastion of common sense in a politically correct world, or is the programme's tedious and bigoted agenda running out of steam? Can radionics kill head lice, or is this methodology a bit of a head-scratcher? And could free beer help stimulate the economy, or would it just allow us to drown our sorrows more easily? But first, if this town is coming like a ghost town, will switching off BBM stop the kids from rioting? It's been a strange week to be a Londoner. Instead of spending our time sweeping chimneys and riding merry-go-rounds inside paintings, this week we've been hostages in our own homes out of fears that young people might stab us up. It was particularly scary for me as a new member of the middle classes, as we only have one day's worth of food left in the house, and the Ocado man might not be able to drive through all the riots. But perhaps one equally horrifying reaction has been that of the politicians. The government, for example, have been saying that they're going to look into switching off social networks next time there's this so-called civil unrest. There's no emoticon for how angry this makes me feel. But is this sort of thing plausible? What has been the role of technology in these riots? Here's Martin Robbins with his take.
Earlier this year, I visited the Kibera slum in south central Nairobi, one of Africa's largest urban slums, housing perhaps 100,000 of the poorest people on this planet, or maybe more, nobody really knows. Walking in with Médecins Sans Frontières was pretty shocking, but beyond the streams of human waste, the kids playing in rubbish, and the need to decontaminate our camera equipment upon leaving, one of the most amazing sights in the slum was the forest of TV aerials and the mobile phone ads plastered on every wall. We even came across a cyber cafe. And like I did, you might think that this is a bit odd. These are incredibly poor people, scraping and scratching a living from charred and tortured earth, living 50 to a shack, a family in each room, barely able to survive, and yet, even for these people, information technology is one of their highest priorities. Mobile phones are so common in Kibera that local aid agencies can track their patients with them. Almost everyone has access to a mobile, several people buying SIM cards for a few pennies and sharing a cheap handset between them. But it isn't odd, because we're the most social creature on the planet, and for our species the ability to communicate is an instinctive need. We feel it like we feel hunger, we want to reach out and find out about our world, to connect with wider society, and we intuitively understand the power of information. It was largely because of mobile phones and the internet that the youth of Egypt, Tunisia and other nations were able to sustain the revolutions of the Arab Spring. Of course, revolution doesn't happen on Twitter or Facebook, but these technologies open our societies and subvert state censorship and propaganda in a way that simply wasn't possible for most of the 20th century. If a policeman beats a student in Tunisia, a kid with a phone can capture an image and beam it around the world in seconds. So in 2011, Pandora's box is fully open, and it cannot be shut. Attempts to stop this flow of information are futile and ultimately self-defeating. When Libyan protest leader Omar Mahmoudi needed an alternative to Twitter and Facebook, he simply turned to dating websites. Australia's Herald Sun newspaper reported that he acted as if he was looking for a wife under the profile name Where is Miriam? And sent coded love letters to spur people to revolution. Since men cannot talk to other men on the site, thousands of revolutionaries posed as women to make contact with him, taking on names such as Sweet Butterfly, Opener of the Mountain, Girl of the Desert, and Melody of Torture. He ended up with more than 170,000 admirers on the site. The activist John Gilmore said in 1993 that the internet interprets censorship as damage and roots around it. Exactly the same thing can be said for social networks and mobile telecommunications. And that brings me in a very roundabout sort of way to the comments made by Boris Johnson's technology advisor, Mike Butcher, on Tuesday in the wake of the third day of what began as the London riots but have since spread to other cities. Butcher tweeted in a somewhat ironic use of a tweet, "It is unbelievable that UK BlackBerry is not shutting down BBM right now." BBM being BlackBerry's secure messaging service, which, like other social networks, such as Twitter and Facebook, has been accused of helping the rioters organise their carnage. This is utterly stupid for two reasons. The first, I've already covered. People are instinctively driven to communicate, and 21st century technology and human ingenuity means that they will continue to talk to each other regardless of the barriers politicians try to put in their way. The second is that it ignores the good, the vast amount of good that social networks have been responsible for in this crisis. In the midst of the rioting, Twitter was used to coordinate support for the elderly and disabled, and people from around the world sent comforting messages to family, friends, and even complete strangers in the affected areas. Afterwards, groups like Riot Cleanup came from nowhere, leveraging the power of the internet to recruit gangs of volunteers who reclaimed the streets with brooms and bin bags and cleared the carnage from the night before. The tweets pinging across cyberspace in any given second are a snapshot, a detailed photograph of the state of our society at one particular moment in time. Like any accurate picture of ourselves, there are parts we like, and then there are things that perhaps we'd rather not see. Social networks capture the good in us, but they also capture some of the bad. But if we shut down our communities because of a few bad people, whether they're city streets or virtual environments, if we lose the love, the cleanup crews and the wombles, then we will all be so much poorer. And whatever the reasons for these riots, whatever the politics, one thing should be obvious to absolutely everyone, just as it was obvious to Norwegians in the wake of the tragic events that unfolded there so recently. When our democracy is faced by fear and violence and extremism, we should meet them with more democracy and with more communication, not less. This has been Martin Robbins for the Pod Delusion.
In trying to explain the riots, politicians seem to have divided into two camps. There's the sheer criminality camp and the underlying socio-economic causes camp. But is it much simpler than this? Could there be a psychological explanation? Here's Dean Burnett, who has got out his psychiatrist's couch and, in his own time, is going to tell us all about it. It's okay, Dean. You are allowed to cry.
In case you were unaware of it, recently there were riots going on in England. If you are one of the people unaware of it, though, I can sympathise. You're probably preoccupied by worrying how you're going to get back to Earth now that the shuttle programme has disbanded. Or maybe you're too busy wondering what that big fiery ball is in the sky and why it keeps coming back every day to taunt you. I am being facetious, of course. It's just that news of the riots and the aftermath is everywhere right now, seemingly across the whole of the Western world and beyond. So the only feasible way you could have missed it is by not being part of that society or not on the planet that it's on. But when a major event with so many participants like this occurs, there's one thing you can guarantee a lot of. Analysis. Media analysis, by the bucket load. It gets to the point where it's overwhelming, says the guy discussing it on a topical podcast like an ass. It's not that it isn't an important issue that really should be understood, as thoroughly as possible, in order to deal with it, or combat it, or whatever verb you like to do with it. It's just that it is such a chaotic set of circumstances involving so many individuals from so many different areas that a soundbite, friendly explanation is about as likely as the riots ending, because Captain Planet turns up to stop it, to prevent all the smoke from those burning cars, you know, some other sort of environmental concern. Obscure references to heavy-handed early 90s cartoons aside, I've said it before and I'll probably say it again. When you're dealing with people, be they in large groups or alone, a simple, easy explanation is very hard to come by. Every person has a complex and varied backstory. This is an inevitable result of being a living, interacting member of society. But even though every person is potentially a smart, insightful, intelligent being, we all have the basic, more primitive behaviours, the animal and reflexive instincts, that have allowed us to survive for 2 million years. It's highly unlikely that such behaviour will quietly go away because we invented the smoke detectors and shock absorbers. And as is always the case, something about us being part of a crowd triggers behaviours we wouldn't normally see in individuals. I'm not going to espouse what the rioters are thinking, or their views, or their reasons or excuses, or their backgrounds or social ideals that make them want to smash and steal and all things like that. I'm nowhere near qualified enough to give such an assessment. But neither is anyone else. However, from a social psychology point of view, the behaviour of crowds and rioters is a very interesting area. And now the increasing involvement of Twitter and other social networks, both as a contributing factor and otherwise, is giving it an extra dimension which wasn't there before. We're all familiar with the term mob rule, or some variation thereof. It is a real thing. Skeptics and the like are often criticised for or accused of groupthink or group mind or some other Orwellian variation on toeing the party line. These accusations are usually from some sort of alt-med peddler, accusing them of not being open-minded and just agreeing with what they're told by the pharmaceutical industry. I'm sure nobody in the sceptic community is unaware of the irony of being told to be open-minded by someone who wouldn't be swayed from their beliefs, not even in return for 72 versions of an iPad 9.0 or whatever the hell they're up to now. But it still can affect sceptics, just as it can any large, interconnected community with any element of self-identification. The effects on psychology, on a person's psychology, of being in a large group are essentially what social psychology is all about. But the context differs, as it does in most things. As members of society, we're always in large groups, but what the aim and point of these groups is varies tremendously. Original experiments, such as the Robbers Cave experiment in 1954, show that a group of individuals, who are initially strangers to each other, can be, through the use of external manipulation, very quickly divided up into groups that are friends, bitter rivals, competitors, and all three and back again. But this experiment was done on a relatively small group of young, middle-class white boys, so all conclusions based on it are going to be questionable in how they apply to the general populace. It would be an organisational nightmare of biblical proportions to study large crowds in laboratory conditions, so social psychologists essentially have to adopt a more passive, anthropological approach to the issue. It's a widely-held belief in the discipline that people caught up in passionate mobs are less capable of complex reasoning and behaviours, and as such they tend to revert to more instinctive, emotive behaviours. Not a great deal of evidence for this, though, aside from what is derived from people's behaviours and how they differ from situations where they are not in mobs. There are many interesting phenomena associated with social psychology, such as the delegation of responsibility and the bystander effect, and that last one is quite unpleasant in its history, but look it up if you have to. My personal view is that as we are social creatures, humans calibrate their importance and sense of worth using other people, so it's only natural to want to go along with the crowd. But our more complex thoughts and behaviours don't communicate so well in these situations. Mob mentality isn't evolved for complexity. It's like trying to send a 10-megapixel photograph by a telegraph system. The system isn't capable of handling that sort of information. That's why we have mobs of people who are quickly angry or scared, but never suddenly develop a communal appreciation for architecture. But that simple emotion conveying bias is just my theory. Feel free to use it. Although bear in mind, I am a doctor of neuroscience who teaches psychiatry now, so it's not like I'm just taking pot shots in the dark here. I have thought about this. I'm not sure how much of this applies to the rioters, though. I could espouse in some scientific theory about group frustrations being invented en masse, but the mob mentality excuse only goes so far, because the people involved decided to join the mob in the first place. If you're part of a peaceful protest and things get nasty, fair enough, that wasn't part of your intention. But if you see the news about people storming the streets, setting fire to things, being violent and generally causing carnage, and you think, I've got to get in on that, then it's quite likely that you are just an arsehole, even when you're on your own. Probably on your own quite a lot, what with being an arsehole. The background of the writers was seemingly so diverse and varied that, as I said, a simple conclusion is impossible. Except for perhaps the one that blames social media. Twitter and its ilk have been great for organising protests, political campaigns, petitions, clean-ups and the like. But the dark side of it is they also offer the same abilities for less noble things, like harassment and criminal endeavours. Just ask Duncan Bannatyne. Today, David Cameron has suggested that police should be able to cut off social media during situations like riots, probably followed by the banning of the printing press and making it illegal for women to learn to read. But as draconian and backward as this would be, the idea somewhat intrigues me, partly because I'd like to see how the police would actually do this, but most because I like to know what the politicians and old media will blame when this move makes no difference at all. But my previous comments about consciously choosing to join a crowd aren't really that valid anymore when you take into account social networks. If you have a computer or a phone, it's pretty much a given that you're a member of a social network of some sort. And if that's the case, can you ever truly be said to be separate from the crowd? Social media has connected people in previously unprecedented ways, to the point where it's clearly unnerving the old political and media institutions that don't understand it and can't figure out how to control it. And it's clearly unsettling to anyone who hasn't followed its progress, seeming to change its format from a means to share amusing cat videos to horrific abuse on comments pages, protest organisation. This happens almost daily. But however you use it, social networks mean we're part of the crowd a lot more than we ever were before. And yes, the electronic method makes sharing of complex ideas and views easier, but now it has to go much further as the crowd is exponentially larger, and everyone's talking at once. Whatever you think of the actions, I do think the social media is something that should be considered when contemplating new laws and policies. You might disagree, but it's what libel law campaigners have been saying for some time now. And you have to take the rough with the smooth, of course. Maybe social media and the web did allow the riots to spread and escalate to a greater degree than they would have without it. But even if you believe that, then the web and social media also allowed information about the dangers, the perpetrators and the cleanup to be propagated to the populace, saving money, time and probably lives in the long run. Social media links us all, and means groupthink and mob mentality is now more pervasive, yet subtle somehow, as a factor in daily life. There is undoubtedly a great deal of scientific study needed here, and I think it would be a great thing to see what they find. Although I'm going to stop there, though, before I start making bizarre claims about the impact on social networks are having on our minds and brains without any evidence to support them. Or, as we call that in neuroscience circles, pulling a Greenfield. This is Dean Burnett, returning to the Pod Delusion now that I've found full-time employment.
And now, one last report on the riots this week. Frank Key's solution is not teaching these kids some respect, but teaching them to read.
In among much blather about the riots, one friend of mine made the definitively sensible comment, "I think the rioters just need to calm down and listen to some Soft Machine." He was thinking specifically of the song Hibou, Anemone and Bear from the dazzling second album, the lyrics of which are as follows. "In the spring I think of sex and means to ends. Summertime I like to sit upon the grass. Autumn nights I go to parties with my friends. Wintertime is when I think about the past. But of course I do all those things all year round. I mean all the good things are there to be found. It's all here. Pick a pack and get to work. If you don't, in actual fact, you'll go berserk, or indeed be bored to death, which is worse. If something's not worth saying, not worth saying, not worth saying, say it." Pondering how else the feral hoodie team persons might be better occupied, I was reminded of a comment made 3 years ago by the blogger Elberry on his now defunct Lumber Room blog. Fortunately, I quoted it on my Hooting Yard blog at the time, so it's not vanished entirely into the ether. Elberry was writing about knife crime rather than brick-throwing, looting and arson, but his point holds good. "I imagine there are several thousand, or hundreds of thousands, of young men carrying knives in self-defence, who will, however, pull it as soon as they imagine a confrontation is in the air. They would be far better to carry expandable batons and far less likely to accidentally kill someone. They would do even better to stay at home reading Sir Philip Sidney." This always seemed to me a sensible, practical and realistic suggestion, and I was happy to quote it in rioting context on Facebook. Cheering too that a number of my friends liked it, and as one commented, "I said almost exactly that to my partner. Why are they not at home reading a book? Any book, even." I'm afraid this led me to give vent to my inner Peter Hitchens, as tends to happen on Facebook, and I immediately replied, "Probably because their teachers were too busy with the self-esteem and diversity lessons to get round to teaching that reading thing." How is it that after 11 years of compulsory education, reportedly 20% of 16-year-olds leave school pretty much unable to read and write? Illiterate, they're unable to feed their imaginations. Maybe that's why they wear hoodies, cutting off their peripheral vision to avoid seeing too much that they can't understand. We're always hearing the teen persons and their adult representatives complain that we have nothing to do. No doubt this has been a teeny moan since time immemorial, but it is, of course, bollocks. Certainly in a city like London, there is a myriad of things to do that don't cost money, even if one is reluctant to sit at home reading a book. But if your mind and imagination are limited because you can't even read, you won't understand the things you can do. It's tragic. For me, the most eloquent snippet of information on the riots was the fact that in Clapham, an entire row of shops was trashed and looted, all except one shop left completely untouched. It was a branch of Waterstones. Asked why he wasn't closing early and boarding the place up, the proprietor said, "Well, if they loot Waterstones, they might just learn something." If only.
This next report contains a fascinating tale by Simon Howard on how the swine flu vaccine that was given out a few years ago increases your chances of getting narcolepsy. It's almost like the MMR causes autism thing, only actually real. Obviously, it's statistically still incredibly unlikely, but as a journalist, I feel obliged to sensationalise the story. So, if you're a parent listening, you must listen to this next report, as your kids are definitely going to get narcolepsy. Here's Simon Howard terrifying us with more. So, who remembers 2009? It was the year Michael Jackson died, the year Albania joined NATO, and the year Al-Megrahi was released from a Scottish prison. Does that help jog your memory? No. Well, of course it won't. The most important thing that happened that year was that the Pod Delusion launched. For many doctors, though, 2009 was the year the long-promised pandemic flu finally arrived, and the NHS swung into full-on pandemic flu control mode with online automated prescribing of antiretrovirals, and practically everyone in hospital who has a temperature being isolated with special precautions that no one really understood, and, of course, an unprecedented mass vaccination programme. It's the latter of those that I personally remember most, because at the time of the swine flu vaccination programme, I was working in a GP surgery. So I had to give this niftily named pandemrix vaccination to loads of people, but it was actually a bit of a bitch. Firstly, unlike your normal seasonal flu vaccinations, it didn't come in nifty pre-filled syringes that make life easy. It came in two vials which had to be mixed together. It's not a hard job, but it was a bit irritating, which, thinking about it, is fairly appropriate because the two vials essentially contained the vaccine and an irritant, or, more correctly, an adjuvant. Adjuvants are special chemicals which are designed to stimulate a bigger immune response than just injecting a vaccine alone. That means that you get a bigger immune response, and it also helps equip your immune system to cope with small mutations of the virus, which is absolutely brilliant in a pandemic situation. It also means that it gives you a more sore arm than most unadjuvanted vaccines. So, I guess I'm confessing that I personally gave hundreds of people a sore arm. Let me say, here and now, sorry, it probably did you some good though, who knows. Of course, you might remember that all the fuss about H1N1 died down relatively quickly. There were a lot of criticism of government overreaction, but we shouldn't forget that actually 500 people died in that outbreak in the UK. Many of those were young people who wouldn't normally die from flu. By all accounts, the pandemic didn't hit the UK as hard as many have predicted. The bodies didn't pile up in the streets, and many of the detailed civil contingency plans weren't needed, but it was a significant event. But anyway, even if there was some over-preparation, nobody came to any harm because of it, did they? Did they? Epidemiological studies in Finland and Sweden have now revealed an apparent association between pandemrix, that vaccine we were jabbing people with, and narcolepsy. It seems that in people aged under 20, administration of pandemrix is associated with a 6 to 13-fold increase in the incidence of narcolepsy. As a result, the European Medicines Agency has restricted the use of pandemrix in people under the age of 20, pending further research. That restriction affects the UK, but no UK body seems to have commented on it yet, but I suspect that before long the MHRA will have to come out with a statement, and the shit will hit the UK's media fan. It's a fantastic tabloid story. Kids across the country advised to get a vaccine that causes a big increase in their risk of narcolepsy. It has everything going for it. It's got kids, it's got compulsion, it's got government overreaction, it's got these really sexily large relative risk numbers, and it's about a disease which the media love. Of course, narcolepsy being rare, the actual risks are small. We're talking about an increase from 5 cases per million to about 30 cases a million. It's really quite a tiny increase in absolute risk. And of course, we've only vaccinated high-risk people. So while swine flu might not have affected healthy people to the predicted extent, people died and high-risk people died more than low-risk people. So given the choice between this vaccine that gives you a tiny risk of narcolepsy and not having the vaccine and having a possibly slightly higher risk of dying, the narcolepsy risk probably seems better. Indeed, the European Medicines Agency agrees with that, saying that you can still use pandemrix in people under 20 if there isn't an alternative vaccine available. But this whole situation raises really, really interesting questions. Of course, the ability of any trial of a new drug to detect rare side effects is really limited, because trials tend to be small compared to the treated population, and small numbers don't lend themselves to finding statistical significance. Normally, that isn't such a massive problem, and we have systems to deal with it. In the UK, we have a black triangle system.
Before I tell you about black triangles, let's take a step back. If a patient has a severe adverse reaction to a drug, this is reported to the MHRA via a yellow card. Traditionally, and to some extent still now, these are literally yellow cards completed with details and posted to the MHRA. But if you're in the 21st century, there is now an online option which is far easier to use. These adverse reactions can be reported by pretty much anyone, from doctors, patients, pharmacists, nurses, and so on and so forth. As an aside, actually, I know that some junior doctors listen to this. And if you aren't reporting adverse drug reactions, you're evil, and you should redeem yourself immediately by starting to do it. MHRA.gov.uk. Right, advert over. That confused the picture, didn't it? Now, when a new medicine is introduced, it's listed in the BNF, which is the book and website and iOS app that's issued to doctors every 6 months, which lists all the dosing regimens for medicines. New medicines are marked with a black triangle, and the MHRA makes a special effort to watch carefully over those black triangle drugs to look for rare side effects, and all adverse reactions, rather than just severe ones, are supposed to be reported by the yellow card system. So, ordinarily, if there's a problem with a new drug, it can be picked up in the early stages of its introduction. But what about situations like swine flu pandemics or other emergency scenarios? You have a problem there because it's difficult to monitor the introduction of a drug. You're giving it out quickly, so an early problem is everyone's problem. So, there's a really tricky ethical judgment to make in those scenarios, because you have to weigh up the probably incompletely known risks of a developing emergency with the unknown risks of rare adverse reactions in the population. Make the wrong call, and not only did you possibly cause deaths one way or the other, you could also undermine your whole response to emergencies and lose control. For example, imagine if the rare side effect here had been immediate horrific death. Would have really undermined the swine flu campaign. Making this more complicated, unlike most doctors, you're not making this judgment on a one-to-one basis. You're making a life or death decision for a whole population. This sort of decision is faced by people who work in public health every day. Many listeners will know that I'm a public health doctor and I'm really passionate about the specialty. And this kind of ambiguous, complex, difficult decision is what I live for. As I said earlier, I know that some junior doctors listen to the Pod Delusion, and I'd really like to encourage you not to write off public health as a career without considering it. I know that sometimes it's taught in medical school really badly and is dull, but it's not. It's really, really interesting, and you should try it. It really is a rewarding choice. Even, actually, if you're not a doctor, but you have some relevant experience in healthcare, you too can be trained up. Applications open in December, so check out fph.org.uk/recruitment, and there's a link to that on the Pod Delusion website. It's a really great job. Come and join me. This has been Simon Howard trying to convince you that he's worth his public sector salary, and trying to convince you that you're worth one too, for the Pod Delusion.
With all of the government's planned cuts, public services are taking a battering. Many councils have been forced to reduce funding for care homes for the elderly, so you'd be forgiven for thinking that perhaps the only old folks' home that definitely hasn't faced cuts is the House of Lords. This week marks the 100th anniversary of the Parliament Act, and 100 years since this country first attempted to reform the chamber. Recently, Nick Clegg did announce plans to finally attempt to reform the chamber, and Corey Hazlehurst thinks it's about time too. And here he is, explaining why.
This week, activists from Unlock Democracy commemorated one of the most significant constitutional reforms in modern Britain by staging a people versus peers tug-of-war event in Westminster. Wednesday, August the 10th, saw the 100th anniversary of the passing of the 1911 Parliament Act, in which the House of Commons committed themselves, in principle, to an elected House of Lords. The Act was a consequence of Lloyd George's so-called People's Budget of 1909, which saw considerable opposition from the Tory-dominated Lords. The Act meant that the Lords could no longer veto legislation, but instead could only delay a bill by a maximum of 2 years. This was amended to 1 year by a subsequent Act passed in 1949. In the preamble to the 1911 Act, Parliament said that the introduction of non-elected lords could not immediately be brought into operation. That's a bit of an understatement now, because 100 years later we're still waiting for an elected upper chamber. However, that doesn't mean that we've had no reform of the Lords at all. We've had a century of very gradual reform. This has changed the Lords from a body made up of hereditary peers who sat in Parliament because their dad did, to an upper house made up primarily of appointed peers. It was New Labour in 1999 who removed most of the hereditary peers, reducing their number from 750 to 92. Peers are now generally appointed because of their particular expertise. That includes former senior politicians and civil servants, and the 206 crossbench peers. This is a group of non-party affiliated experts and includes people such as the philosopher Mary Warnock, the pentathlete Tanny Gray Thompson, and the political historian Peter Hennessy. The main case for an elected House of Lords rests on the pretty simple principle that those who make our laws should be democratically accountable to the public. In the vast majority of established democracies, at least part of a country's upper chamber includes an elected element of some sort. Some argue that introducing an elected second chamber would undermine the supremacy of the Commons. It would undoubtedly do that, since an elected Lords would have much more legitimacy when it voted against a bill that was passed in the Commons. At the moment, however, our current electoral system means that parties can gain a large majority in the Commons on the minority of the votes. This was a situation described by Lord Hailsham as an elective dictatorship. He was a Lord Chancellor in the Tory governments of Ted Heath and Margaret Thatcher, so he's not exactly a typical hand-wringing electoral reform campaigner. Having a check on this sort of executive power would therefore be no bad thing. The best argument against House of Lords reform is that you would lose the expertise and experience of the crossbench peers. One solution to this would be to put crossbenchers on the relevant select committee for which they have an expertise. Select committees do a great job of scrutinising legislation and making amendments, but they could always be improved with the addition of a particular expert. Alternatively, provision could be made for unelected peers to sit in a mainly elected House of Lords. This is the solution that Nick Clegg has gone for with his proposals for Lords reform. The initial proposal is for the Lords to be composed of 300 members, of which 80% are elected. Of the 60 non-elected members that would be appointed, 12 would be bishops, and the other 48 would be crossbenchers. Peers will be elected under the single transferable vote, or STV, system, in regions that would be the same as those for European Union elections. STV would have the advantage of making it easier for independents to win seats, as well as candidates from parties that are currently underrepresented in the Commons, such as the Greens or the UK Independence Party. Some reformers argue, however, that these proposals don't go far enough, and we should have an all-elected House of Lords rather than 80% elected. The main downside of these plans is that the Lords would have one-off terms of 15 years. Not only does this seem too long, but also seems to me to sidestep the main value of having elected upper house. The advantage of having elected peers would be that you could get rid of them if you don't like the job they're doing. If peers don't have to seek re-election, then how can we ensure they become accountable to the public? Nevertheless, these proposals are a stratospheric improvement on the present system. The question remains, however, of whether these proposals will become reality. Labour tried many times to reform the Lords, but a lack of enthusiasm from Tony Blair meant that an elected upper house never materialised under his premiership. As well as a lack of enthusiasm, another reason why House of Lords reform has never materialised is because of a lack of consensus. As Labour's Lord Adonis, himself a supporter of an elected upper house, has said, "If you get 20 ministers in the room, you'll get 25 proposals for an elected House of Lords." In March 2007, MPs voted by a considerable majority for an elected House of Lords, but because there was no agreement on what exactly the composition of this chamber should be, these plans remained pipe dreams. This lack of consensus was evident when Nick Clegg unveiled his proposals to Parliament in May. Despite all three main parties committing themselves in their manifestos to an elected Lords, there was outright hostility from many Tory MPs, and indifference from Labour, who might find the chance to kick Clegg too tempting to resist. Peter Hennessy has said that House of Lords reform is the Bermuda Triangle of British politics. Those who try and enact reform generally end up disappearing. Nick Clegg doesn't exactly have a lot of political capital to get these reforms through. It would be a great boost to British democracy if he did, but don't hold your breath. This was Corey Hazelhurst of paperbackrioter.wordpress.com for the Pod Delusion.
Now, if you tuned into last week's show, you'll have heard Tom Williamson explaining why, to cut a long story short, that Morrissey, the overrated loudmouth pop singer, was wrong about something. Dan Swindlehurst doesn't think that Tom's points were so much an animal right as an animal wrong, as he explains in this next report.
Last week, Tom Williamson rightfully criticised Morrissey for his insensitive and deliberately incendiary comments comparing the recent massacre in Norway with the killing of animals for human consumption. Whilst I agree that Morrissey's comments were appalling, I disagree with Tom's argument that they were appalling because humans are inherently more important than animals. Morrissey's statement was deplorable because death isn't about comparison. If your grandmother died and a friend said something like, "Well, one death is bad, but think of all the deaths in Iraq, that's much worse," then you'd probably be pretty pissed off, because one death doesn't trump another. They're all bad. Trying to compare them is offensive and a little idiotic. To demonstrate the importance of humans, last week Tom asked if you would rather save a baby or two mice in a cage from a burning house. As, he claimed, if species are equally important, then surely you'd pick the mice, as they outnumber the baby 2-1. I suspect almost everyone would choose to save the baby, though. But this doesn't demonstrate the greater importance of humans. I don't think humans are more important than mice, but I would save the baby rather than the mice because I'm human, and I prefer humans to mice. Except Piers Morgan, obviously. To me, this question has nothing to do with objective species importance, and everything to do with species bias. It's easier for me to see other animals die rather than humans, because I am human, not because we're more important. So why don't I think humans are more important? Well, the argument for the primacy of humans typically runs along the lines of, we've achieved a greater level of sentience, intelligence or technology than other species. Therefore, we are the master race of Earth. As Tom says, we are the only species that has been to the moon, as far as we know. I understand this argument, but have little sympathy for it. Our intelligence is one possible evolutionary adaptation to the struggle for survival. There are many others, though. You could equally well argue that flight is the most important evolutionary adaptation. No, birds haven't been to the moon, but equally, no human has achieved unaided flight. Is intelligence more important than flight? Important how? Human intelligence can hardly be said to have benefited the majority of the species we share the Earth with. It's mostly just benefited humans. And rats. What I'm getting at here is that deciding that intelligence is a superior evolutionary adaptation is a purely subjective one, but one that humans are probably biased towards because it's the adaptation we excel at the most. It's a bit like a champion javelin thrower deciding they are the best athlete in the world, as it's clear to them that the javelin is a superior athletic event, when the rest of us clearly know it's ice dancing. This is a subjective and biased judgment, as is the judgment that humans are the most important species. I believe this notion of the importance of humanity derives from the popular misconception that humans are the pinnacle of evolution. But this is a nonsensical and, quite frankly, religious idea, as evolution is a random process with no design or direction. Humanity was not the destiny of evolution, because evolution has no destiny. Furthermore, I find it hard to consider a species as important when we've existed for such a minuscule amount of time, geologically speaking. Particularly when we show no real aptitude for long-term global level planning and coordination, humanity may well prove to be a rather short-lived species and to be a brief footnote in the evolution of life on Earth. I might be more inclined to believe that human intelligence is the creme de la creme of evolutionary innovations if it was put to good use. Sure, we've been to the moon and invented curry, but we've also spawned Justin Bieber and mayonnaise. You could very easily argue that humanity, and our intelligence, is actually the most damaging evolutionary innovation nature has spawned. We are, after all, making quite a big mess of our planet's biosphere and show no signs of stopping. I'd love to believe humans have a galactic destiny spreading intelligence and curry throughout the galaxy, but the odds are it won't happen. We'll probably stay at home and make a bit more of a mess instead. So please don't think that I prefer other species to humans, or that I'm some kind of environmental extremist who hates humanity for its destruction of the ecosphere. But please don't also jump to the supposedly obvious conclusion that humans are inherently more important than other species just because we have iPads. Think a little more deeply about why you feel we're more important, and if it's really justified. Now back to the curry and ice dancing. This has been Dan Swindlehurst for The Pod Delusion.
Now, if you're a fan of cars and ignorance, then you'll no doubt be a fan of Top Gear. In a recent programme, they appear to have crossed a line from scripted banter into transparently pushing their anti-environmentalist agenda. Tom Hodden this week has been thinking about some of the flaws in their recent review of electric cars. Personally, I'm not too worried about Top Gear. After all, we'll have the last laugh when the ice caps melt and global temperatures rise, killing millions of people and wiping out millions of homes. At least we'll get to tell Jeremy Clarkson that we told him so. Here's Tom Hodden with more.
I've been thinking a lot about the electric car and why it's never caught the public imagination. This week I saw possibly one of the worst tests I've ever seen. The Jolly Rags on Top Gear, a show that always emphasises the mental when saying environmentalists, put electric cars to the test. Guess what? They didn't fare well. Least of all, because the self-proclaimed petrol heads did not actually test anything they did not already know the result of. Now, I'm aware that if you want some serious scientific data, then this is not the show to be watching. But I'm old-fashioned. I can remember when Top Gear was only half an hour long, talked about cars I might one day afford to own, and actually offered consumer advice. And that is what the show still claims, however vaguely, to do. It reviews cars, presumably to say if they're any good or not. A review, even one for the sole purposes of entertainment, should at the very least try to contain some kind of useful information. The opinions of the piece should be informed and informative, which the Top Gear review not only failed to do, but tried to hoodwink me. Now let's get something straight. I'm not annoyed because they dish the electric car. The electric car has serious limitations that the new models have to address. At the moment, the most viable option for most families wanting to lower their carbon footprint with an electric vehicle is a hybrid car. If future generations of hybrids meet projected standards, we will, fingers crossed, be looking at cars within the near future with a tiny half-litre engine purely for the purpose of keeping batteries topped up with electricity through a generator. But just like old diesel electric trains used to do, although they had somewhat larger engines. But, that said, the current generations of electric car are fairly good at the job they are designed to do within the claimed limitations of the design. Your average electric car is basically an electric motor bolted onto a bank of batteries. They're city cars for short day-to-day journeys to and from home, school, the shops. Once parked, they can remain on charge and gradually top up their electricity. Should you get a low battery indicator, you are likely to leave the car charging overnight or all day. The downside to this is that just like your mobile phone, if you charge every night, it can be hard on the batteries and be detrimental to the life of the battery. For those engineers amongst you who use a UPS or an industrial battery charger as a backup for the power supply at your work, will point out that this degeneration is not excessive. Modern batteries are more robust and reliable, and to completely discharging a cell can also have risks. In the techno lingo, the electric car is a battery charger on wheels that, when parked, plugs in to charge the batteries on a float charge. Realistically, the battery should be changing after several years. Given that there is such a small number of moving parts in the car, the batteries are the most major concern in general use. Realistically, we can look at the electric car being made for the specific use of city driving, just as some cars are designed for track days, or long-distance drives, or off-road driving, or family holidays, and so on and so forth. Electric cars, and presumably electric vans, are going to be bought by families or businesses who expect to drive in a very limited radius for very limited periods of time. It's not a new model, and electric cars are not the only vehicles to cater for this model. How many smart cars or mopeds have you seen around the city, driven by the general public or plastered in corporate identity? Top Gear did not test the vehicles in those limitations of design or the intended use. They did not use it for short journeys and commuter hops between places where they knew they could charge the car. They took the cars to the seaside. Now, assuming that the researchers and journalists did the basics of their job, they would have known the destination was a lot further away than the range of the car. Heck, the drivers must have known this, because both James May and Jeremy Clarkson, who were driving the cars in the review, referred to the range of their respective cars featuring on the displays as they drove. So they knew the cars would not complete the journey. They set a task. They knew the electric cars would fail to make a point. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a bad test. But more importantly, if intended for laughs or not, it tried to hoodwink us into thinking electric cars had been given a fair crack at the whip and found lacking in a vital area. Which is odd, as milkmen have been driving electric floats for short urban journeys for more years than I've been alive, and not one of them has ever complained that it conked out on the way to their holiday. On the other hand, Some of those apparently far superior sports cars are utterly useless when you try to use them as transit vans, people carriers, or to use them outside of their limitations in other ways. But sports cars get tested on a high-speed track, and the latest Land Rover gets tested off-road. Why not the same for the electric car? Why not test it for what it was built for? Is there likely to be world-changing ramifications to the show turning a road test into a joke? Of course not. Top Gear has hardly hired a peer review for the auto industry. I doubt any serious opinions were swayed for or against by two old men marooning some sort of road trip. Obviously, not everything in the world can be run to the stringent rules of science, where the distinction between proof, evidence and subjective opinion are well defined. Reviews or product tests in any media obviously have to be subjective to the author's opinions of what is good or bad, enjoyable or dull, and to the editorial stance of the media concerned. But increasingly, we are living in a world where the lines between what can be proven as fact and what can just be called fact are being blurred. In a light-hearted motoring show, it is one thing. In adverts or newspapers, it is another. A certain level of responsibility is surely a requirement for free speech. Although reviews can rarely afford to be objective, you should expect not just a modicum of fairness, but at the very least, some care to be taken to use the product for its intended purpose when deciding whether it's fit for that purpose. The show, if we like it or not, is incredibly popular with the general public, and the three hosts all have opinion pieces in other media outlets. It's no surprise they don't like electric cars, any more than it's a surprise that they don't like speed cameras or mock environmentalists. Top Gear is not to blame for the misconceptions, but they do illustrate very well, indeed, what the misconceptions about electric cars are. Like many new technologies, before society embraces the electric car, it will have to understand that it is a new product, and not just a slightly greener version of the old product, traditional petrol-driven cars, and that it's expected to be used in a different way, with different habits. We have to be realistic about what expectations we can place on the new technology, and who it will suit. We can't assume that anyone who drove a car will get along fine with an electric car. However, we also have to recognise that there are a lot of people who every day do exactly the kind of journey that an electric car would suit, that an electric car would make cheaper, and that an electric car would make a lot more efficient. In time, electric cars would greatly benefit. But at the moment, those needs simply won't be recognised because we're too busy making the wrong comparisons. This has been Tom Hodden for the Poddle.
Now we've got an intriguing tale from Adam Curden on how he managed to bring down an entire charity. Don't worry, he hasn't been torpedoing aid ships or releasing bears into cats' homes. Instead, he's been taking on a charity that has been promoting nonsense. Here's Adam with more.
I did not set out to destroy a decades-old charity. That was more of a bonus. But perhaps I should start from the beginning. The Maybritton Trust was set up in 1987 to promote radionics. Radionics is a somewhat obscure field, I realize, though, so I'd best explain it. It dates back to the early 20th century, a time of snake oil salesmen and widespread quackery. One of these quacks, American Albert Abrams, decided that the best money was in distance healing. What he did was he took a drop of blood, a bit of hair, or even a person's signature, and put it in a complicated mechanical electrical device. Complicated enough that the patient believed that it must be doing something, and then he healed the patient from afar using this device, or so he claimed, and he dubbed this bizarre use of machines and distance healing radionics. It's basically sympathetic magic, of course. Using a small part of something to affect the whole. The patient basically supplies a practitioner with some part of his or herself to allow said practitioner to make an electromechanical voodoo doll. Since Abrams' time, the field has grown a bit to include other quack medical devices, such as the various automatic diagnosis machines and the rather futile attempts to cure diseases with sound frequencies, such as a Rife machine or Huldus Clark's Sapper, as well as rather strange devices such as a power balance bracelet or a badge with the drawing of a unicorn that repels hair lice. We'll come back to that last one in a little bit. Going back to our history, the Mayberton Trust was founded by Major Gordon Smith. He became a fan of radionics after one of his horses injured his back in the vets, according to Smith, wanted to have it put down. He sent some of the horse's hair to a radionics practitioner who assured him those nasty vets were wrong, so he decided that X-ray evidence wasn't as good as radionics and kept the horse. Skeptics have attacked the Mayberton Trust for years. An article in The Independent in 1996 attacks radionics extensively, but doesn't seem to have resulted in any action. Ben Goldacre's Bad Science blog post of January 30, 2010, discusses the Mayberton Trust and pours particular shame on a pin-on badge of a unicorn claimed to repel head lice, but nothing came of that at the time either. However, when it was discovered again back in May of this year, things went very differently. Unlike all the other skeptical discoveries of the Mayberton Trust, this one happened after a watershed moment. The Advertising Standards Authority gained power over online advertisements and had chosen the Mayberton Trust as their first big investigation. Indeed, Marsh tells me that skeptics with a K discovered it through the ASA education on the product, reviewing it on what would turn out to be one of its last days in existence. Let's quote from a Press Association article quoted in several places online. I took this quote from the copy on MSN.com. Lice advert banned in online first. The advertising watchdog has banned an internet promotion in our landmark online education. Holistic health charity Mayberton Trust has now been forced to drop part of its web marketing campaign for a head lice repelling device after it fell foul of the Advertising Standards Authority, ASA. The case is the first of its kind and comes after the watchdog broadens its remit to cover digital advertising. Press reports are all very good, but the education discovered something shameful. The Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, MHRA, had reviewed and approved the product, despite the ASA finding no robust evidence for it when they checked. This failure of the MHRA to protect the public against an obvious quack product, instead giving them their seal of approval, means that the MHRA cannot be trusted to protect the populace from fraudulent claims. I listen to skeptics with a K, and when I hear about something, I like to look into it. However, by the time I looked, the Mayberton Trust had pulled all the head lice material from their site in response to the ASA education. Skeptics of the K describes extensive reports on the badge, trial data, and much else. That was all gone when I looked, making it far easier to find their other products, and they were very problematic. My actual ASA complaint covered dozens. It gets worse, though. On their page explaining radionics, they have an image, which I'll ask James to include on the Pod Delusion site. It's talking about how Abrams, founder of radionics, discovered he could diagnose disease by tapping on the abdomen and listening for a dull sound. First disease it shows how to diagnose: cancer. I thought this charity was dangerous, so I complained to the Charities Commission as well as the ASA. The ASA began an investigation, then stopped as the owner had agreed to take down the site. The Charities Commission were very hesitant to act, but I kept forwarding them everything I got from the ASA, and finally, last week, got a letter from them. They were closing the case, as the charity had decided to cease trading. So, how do I feel about this? I'm not sure. I could feel sympathy for the possibly deluded people who really thought radionics work, but at the same time, they were selling unicorn badges for head lice, and apparently selling similar things for fleas and ticks. They talk about radionics being used to diagnose cancer. They even had a page on their site which asked for some information, then asked you to sit quietly while a progress bar went across the page, which apparently heals you. Did anything else happen? Perhaps, but I could find nothing that explicitly said what, if so. Did they really believe in what they did? I don't know, and can't know. But I do think that the products could have caused harm to others, and thus, it's best they no longer exist. This is Adam Cureden,
with his cute little cat, Gwyneth. Reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, it's easy to forget that with the civil unrest, massive cuts and government by the rich for the rich, that the economy isn't in the best of health. Economic growth has been sluggish, and there's a real risk that we'll fall back into what economists call negative growth. I know this sounds like an oxymoron, but I guess they call it this because they don't want to use words like shrinkage in the context of George Osborne. But Adam Jacobs has stumbled upon an innovative idea which he thinks could kickstart things again. So here he is, explaining more.
The UK economy is going through a bad patch. We've recently been through what some have described as the worst recession since the 1930s. The economy has been flat for the last two quarters, with the 0.5% growth in the last quarter only cancelling out the 0.5% contraction in the previous one. Economists are divided, aren't they always, on whether we're at serious risk of a double-dip recession, but it certainly can't be ruled out. Economists are also divided on how we should solve the problem. Some say we should continue to borrow money to stimulate the economy. Others say it's important to get the deficit under control. None of them really makes a particularly good case that they're sure they're going to be able to solve the problem. So clearly, a new and radical solution is needed. Well, I say new, but I'm pretty sure the idea I'm about to share with you is not new. In fact, I think it may even have formed part of the Monster Raving Loony Party manifesto at some time. But hey, desperate times call for desperate measures. So, what is this solution? Simple. Free beer! Yes, that's right. Free beer. What I'm proposing is that the government spends taxpayers' money on buying us all a pint. This is the ultimate in Keynesian stimulus theory. It would get money into the economy in a splendidly practical way. The best thing about it is that it really wouldn't cost all that much in the grand scheme of things. Let's suppose it costs £3 to buy someone a pint. Actually, that's a bit on the high side, especially given the economies of scale if you suddenly bought everyone in the whole country a pint, but let's go with that for now. Let's suppose you buy everyone two pints on 5 days of the week. That would actually take you over your recommended units, and you shouldn't drink that much anyway, so again, a high-ish estimate. So, given that the adult population of the UK is about 50 million, that means the policy would cost £3 times 2 pints times 5 days times 52 weeks times 50 million people, or about £78 billion a year. OK, that sounds like a lot of money, but remember it's a high estimate, and I've also not taken into account that a lot of that £3 is tax and duties anyway, so it goes straight back to the Treasury. So, in fact, it's really a massively high overestimate. But more to the point, remember that it cost about £850 billion to bail out the banks. I think we'd all agree that the bankers owe us a pint, wouldn't we? Just think about the benefits. Clearly, pub owners will be delighted. They'll have profitable and thriving businesses. Breweries will do pretty well too. And just think how good we'll all feel. Remember that in many ways, the economy is more about psychology than about maths. It's all to do with the feel-good factor. If people think things are okay, then they spend money, which gets the economy going, and then things become okay. Seriously, can you think of anything that would help the feel-good factor more than buying everyone a pint? Once we start to feel good, we'll all go and spend money on other things, and the economy will start to boom again. Oh sure, I dare say the naysayers will think of problems with this plan. For one thing, wouldn't it contribute to problems of alcoholism and binge drinking? Well, yes, that is a serious concern, but that's why you'd limit the amount of free beer per person. Only the first couple of pints would be free. You could easily control that with some sort of smart card technology. Or if you wanted to be less high-tech about it, the government could print beer tokens with specific dates on them so you couldn't just save them all up for a weekend binge. And then what about people who don't drink beer? Some may not drink it for religious reasons, others for health reasons, and others because they had to drive to the pub. I hear there are even one or two strange folk who just don't like beer, although personally I find that rather hard to believe. Well, I guess you could buy them an orange juice instead, couldn't you? If we can put a man on the moon, I'm sure we can figure out a way to do that. And here's another thought. Imagine if foreign tourists were also eligible for free beer. Just think what that would do to tourism. Tourists would flock to our shores, encouraged by the free beer, and would spend huge amounts of money here, probably putting our balance of payments into surplus at a stroke. and we'd also have a bit of fun reading the apoplectic headlines in the Daily Mail. Bloody foreigners, they come over here drinking our beer. Apart from the economic benefits, there'd also be massive social benefits. Many people are worried about a lack of community cohesion in modern society. How many of us know our neighbours these days? Well, if we all spent a few evenings a week at our local, we'd all get to know each other better, wouldn't we? It would be the first step to a more cohesive and friendly society. Of course, back in the real world, it'll never happen. Not because it's a bad idea, not because it's unaffordable. The reason it will never happen is just because it sounds frivolous and silly. Politicians are, for the most part, deeply inadequate people who need to be taken seriously by others to help them regain some vestige of a sense of self-worth. The one thing they fear above all else, well, maybe with the exception of having their expenses claims audited, is appearing to be anything less than completely serious. No politician would ever dare to vote for free beer because somebody might think it was a bit silly. And here's a thought. If this idea, which I genuinely think has some economic merit, is destined never even to be considered by our political rulers on the grounds that it sounds a bit silly, you wonder how many other really good ideas there are out there that sound a bit silly at first, which will also never be considered. This has been Adam Jacobs for The Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back to older episodes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Also on our website, you can listen and subscribe to the Pod Delusion Extra feed, which features extended reports and interviews, longer versions of stuff on the show, as well as other recordings and bonus podcasts and lectures, and so on. For example, if you enjoyed our David Attenborough interview last week, you can hear 21 unadulterated minutes of Attenborough-tastic content. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. Also on our website, awkward begging bit alert, you can donate money to the Pod Delusion. I know it's very crude to ask, so if you'd like to support the podcast, why not subscribe for £5 or £10 a month or make a one-off donation to help us along and help us keep doing what we do. Finally, and most importantly, if you live in the Leicester area, do come along to Leicester Skeptics in the Pub next week on Tuesday the 16th of August, where we'll be doing a live podcast recording at Leicester Skeptics. You can find details and all that sort of thing on the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Martin Robbins, Dean Burnett, Frank Key, Simon Howard, Corey Hazelhurst, Dan Swindlehurst, Tom Hodden, Adam Curden, Adam Jacobs, and me, James O'Malley. The sketches were by David Lovesey and Brian Too, with additional editing by Deputy Editor Liz Luckendorf. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Writing thing is well good.
Yeah, you was telling me, bruv. Yeah, we showed them.
The government, right? Yeah, the government. They's listening now.
Truth, bruv. Yeah, truth. Yeah, yeah. And I got me some new trainers.
Result?
I know. But these is eights, and tonight I'm going to go back, see if I can get me a nine. Because these is pinching, you know?
Safe.
It is buzzing out there.
Do you know what else, though, bruv? Just so they know I'm in business, right? Just so they know, right? I torched the motor.
Oh, that is sick.
I know, man. It was blazing, bruv.
But what was it, though?
It was a BMW.
Oh, wicked, bruv. Wicked.
I know.
Yeah, but where was it, though?
Just out here.
No, the blue one.
Yeah, man, the blue one. The 320i.
No, that was my mum's, you dickhead. Oh, bruv. She's going to go proper mental.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and how am I going to get back to uni in September if you ain't got no car? Oh, bruv. There's no way I'm going to get all my stuff in the old man's Porsche.
Laters, man, I got a blow.
What is that then, bruv?
I got a cello lesson with Mrs. Doyle.
Right.